Okay, we are back for episode 133. Joe, how you doing?
I think this is 134.
No, I miscounted last time. It's 133.
Oh, did you? Oh my God.
So it is 133.
Mistake you've ever made, Tim. I'm going to have to write this down. Amazing.
First recorded mistake. I cover my tracks.
No. Okay, good.
Okay, so tonight we wanted to talk about what's going on with Japan and its declining population. But first, we've had some recent developments, current events.
Yeah, the U.S. blew up Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general. It occurred in Iraq, the event, but he was definitely targeted. And so everyone is wondering about the response. An hour or so ago, they blew up another group of basically, you know, military officials that are related to his group. I think these were more, local militia people. I don't think they were basically Iranian army people, but nevertheless, it was part of the attempt to crush Iran. And a lot of people have been asking, I'm getting emails from people asking like, well, why did we do this? And I would point out that, just on the surface, it seems insane because we didn't need to do it per se. I mean, he wasn't about to invade New York or something. And it seems as though Iran is in a situation where they have to respond. And then, of course, we would probably respond to the response and then off we go. So this it just seems very irrational and sad. And I was curious, Tim, is this legal? I mean, can you target?
It's far beyond legal now. Does a state of war exist between Iran and the United States? Has Congress declared war?
Yeah, I don't think there's a war. So how do they actually legally do
that? And he wasn't in Iran; he was in Iraq,
right?
Which is a sovereign state, right?
Yeah, well, supposedly. I think one of the things was they've been having these demonstrations against the U.S. president. I mean, obviously, the Iraqi people are aware now that they've been colonized, right? I mean, they're starting to understand this. And so they're going to respond with these kinds of demonstrations. So I kind of think in a broad stroke that what they were doing with this was just basically putting the lash to the mind of the Iraqi rebels. So that they would see that, we can kill anyone anytime and just get back in line.
Yeah, there was that apparently a mob raided the embassy there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I think, is in back of it. And then the question of Iran's response, I just can't imagine they won't do something. If one of our generals was in Italy and was targeted by some group and blown up. I mean, we of course the U.S. is different since we're sort of the world dictator, but certainly there would be a response. And I'm just wondering, do you think that they are actually expecting the response and then basically setting up a kind of escalation into warfare? And I'll just, before you answer, just point out that you recall, I'm sure, Wesley Clark's statement following September 11th, where he said he went into the Pentagon and talked to a general and he listed all these, said Egypt, Syria, Libya, he listed all of the countries that have since been blown up. But if you listen to his statement, he says, and at the end of it, Iran. Mm-hmm. And this is, I would just say, roughly a biblical configuration. I mean, they mentioned Yemen, but other than that, basically you have from the Nile to the Euphrates, the biblical idea of Israel. And there had been, you know, there was the Project for the New American Century position paper, and then there was another one that came from the same group, and I think it was called Defense of the Realm. I forget what it was called. But it actually also mentioned the same configuration of, you know, full spectrum dominance over all of these countries. And so, you know, if this is, as Wesley Clark stated, simply the plan, then it's time for Iran. It's time for us to set up the pretext for a full-scale invasion, which would be pretty horrific because my understanding is the Iranians could fight back.
Yeah, they have, I believe they have missiles which can target aircraft carriers. And, you know, of course, Iran is much bigger than Iraq. And so it's not quite the cakewalk, yeah. You know, as Iraq was supposedly. So, you know, and then this whole thing, you know, it raises all types of questions. Why is the U.S. government targeting an Iranian general in Iraq? Now, of course, these Shiite militias are supposedly supported by Iran, because that's a Shia state. And of course, Saddam Hussein's regime was a Sunni state, the Sunni minority government. And so when they took out Saddam Hussein and his regime collapsed, you know, it created a vacuum that the Shias were going to fill. So the strategic problem the United States supposedly faces with Iran in the area, of course, was a direct result of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the destruction of the Saddam Hussein regime. Because this goes back to 1980 when the U.S. supported, you know, Iraq's war against Iran. And, you know, supported kind of both sides, more supported Iraq's side more, but kind of prolonged that conflict, made it last a better part of, I think, 8-9 years, you know. And this also set the stage for the 90 war, because it was the debt that Iraq had built up waging that war were one of the reasons why Saddam Hussein decided to invade Kuwait in 1990. That and the slant drilling issue, which April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador, said the United States had no position on, sort of drawing him in, you know. And even going further back is, you know, so Central Command, which is a grew out of the Rapid Deployment Force, which President Carter created in response to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, which was characterized as sort of a prelude to further aggression in the Middle East. When we now know that that invasion was kind of, they were lured in there by the United States in the summer of 79, and Zbigniew Brzezinski bragged about creating this conditions in Afghanistan that drew the Soviets in. So at each stage of the game, it's got creating a pretext, creating a future conflict or crisis or strategic problem, which then again they have to respond to. But they never seem to solve any problems. They just seem to drag these problems out, create new ones. At the end of the day, the winner is the military industrial complex in Israel.
Yeah, I actually think that, you know, we've talked about Syria, Egypt, you know, we've had many discussions about the situation in the Middle East. And I take the position that it's completely incomprehensible and is so deliberately because the battles, the tactical skirmishes are just camouflage for the actual agenda, which is simply to genocide the Muslim population in Eretz Israel.
Yeah, they have the Oran Inan plan, which the United States seems to be helping, you know, at least executing. And you know, the whole thing with ISIS, which is supported by Israel and the United States, which everyone kind of knows, no one talks about it. So they contradict. I mean, ISIS is supposed to be the enemy. Then how do you rationalize that with the clear support it's getting, you know, from Israel and the fact that it's operating in an area, you know, that oil. The area that ISIS controlled was selling oil to Turkey, which is a NATO member of NATO.
Well, the whole thing was just ridiculous. Yes, it was just such a fake setup. I mean, and the assassination of Soleimani is just right in that theme, because he was the one guy who was actually able to destroy ISIS to some extent. Yes. I mean, he was the most effective fighter against it.
Yeah, Soleimani opposes ISIS, which is Sunni.
Yeah, that's
right. So again, it's they're relying on the American people having a short attention span, not thinking this through. It doesn't make any sense if you're fighting. But they're not, because what you want is you want the infighting, because that's all part of the greater plan. Because what the Israelis want is a bunch of Muslims fighting each other, small states, that aren't functional. And that's one thing that Iraq was, and that was smashed. And of course, Egypt was, and that was smashed. And Syria was, and that was smashed. And they haven't been fully been able to capable to achieve victory in Syria. But remember, in Syria, ISIS were the good guys. They were the moderate rebels. As
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, stand back to look at the larger picture, it really makes no sense other than it's what it is. It's mayhem, and that is that Odan Ninan plan, which the Israelis want, which is all the surrounding states being in a state of chaos and being weak so they can expand and get, and they're relying on the United States government to do the heavy lifting there to get a lot of the blame. Hasn't been one reported ISIS attack against Israel,
of course
that tells you something.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, when you like you said, when you stand back a bit and kind of look at these broader strokes, I mean, it just is so completely artificial. The whole Middle East conflict is so obviously just a cover story for depopulation. I mean, we talked like a couple of weeks ago about Saudi Arabia. How fake that state is, how it was set up, mm-hmm. The families were put in place. The real Muslim leaders had all been, were basically targeted for assassination. And the British Freemasons who were running the area, they simply told the other states that, you know, we control Saudi Arabia and we will launch it against you like some kind of falcon on a, you know, on a falconer's arm if you don't do what we say, which in that case specifically was accept Zionism. That was really, at that point, there was a real clarity in terms of the issues. So then the State of Israel came into existence, and no sooner than that, then you started having the idea of like the state, which of course has never declared its borders or its constitution, so you don't really know what it is, started to expand, right? Mm-hmm. The territories, you know, the settlements, they just kept pressing out. And everything I think that we're seeing now is just like, basically, it's a continuation of the settlements. And that's why I would recommend highly Noor Massala's book, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, because it basically gives such clarity to the to the facade of the project for Israel being anything other than a complete Jewish state with no Muslims whatsoever inside the territories and with the moral authority to genocide. I mean, Marsala just does an incredible job of documentation because he gets the letters of all of the most famous Zionists. And he gives complete citations. It's a very scholarly work. It's not, you know, some kind of conspiracy theory thing. It's just a very scholarly work showing you that from the very beginning, the idea was depopulation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then when you see like how the Palestinians are being treated, it makes perfect sense. I mean, they have already abandon any kind of moral issue in terms of, is there humanity here we have to respect? No, there isn't any. They are completely focused on the chosen people, on themselves, the Jews, and in order to reclaim what they see as the God-given area. And of course, God was vague too. I mean, God unfortunately didn't write a constitution, so we don't really know where the borders are. You know, it's somewhere between the Nile and the Euphrates, but it's vague, so who knows? And unfortunately, anyone who lives in that area, anyone nearby it, from the perspective of the people who created the letters which they exchange and then were the founders of Israel, there just isn't any moral issue about genocide. I mean, they talk about Golda Meir in one of the letters. She talks about violence, and she said, is there a moral issue? And the respondent says, no, I don't have any. You know, it's very, very straightforward. There's some, you know, kind of couching of the language, but in general, they're operating in kind of the Zionists are operating in a kind of Deuteronomy, I would call it. You know, God has authorized the genocide of certain ethnicities. You know, it's just like in like Deuteronomy 21. So you get that perspective. And then, you know, remember that that there is this artificiality, that we're always being deceived, because in the case of Zionism and the founding of Israel, when you go through Marsala's book, Marsala takes like a straight face. You know, he goes, well, they're all this complication in dealing with Britain, which was, you know, the ruling power. But if he would just go back, you know, 30 or 40 years and look at the proto-Zionists, you know, the Churchills and Palmerston and these guys, he would see that it's actually, the whole thing is just a facade. You see, that the Zionists are basically negotiating with themselves. And when you get things like the Peel Commission and all these different commissions trying to look at ways to make, you know, the Palestinians basically have some kind of deal, which isn't just a raw-faced genocide that the world might protest, it's all just theater. There's nothing real about it at all. And that's really important to understand, Tim, because when you come to this episode, right, and you listen to Lindsey Graham talking about you know, like Soleimani as kind of, you know, this Hitler type character that you know, that the Democrats are too cowardly. Well, I'm afraid that the whole thing is just theater. I mean, they know perfectly well that you know, that the kind of normal rights of the Iranians to defend themselves are not going to be acceptable here, and that they are basically moving toward a kind of greater Israel. And that's really what I think you're seeing with the Soleimani. I think it's a lesson to the Iraqi, you know, protesters about the colonialization. And it's also an excuse. They're going to, I think, create an excuse for more genocide, for more just depopulation of Muslims.
Yeah, well, for most Americans, he's got a, you know, funny foreign sounding name, so it's okay.
Kill him.
You know.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, of course, Congress won't be impeaching Trump for this.
No. And, you know, Tim, I was going to ask you, whatever happened to drain the swamp? I mean, all the people that thought Trump was like this, you know, kind of, oh, my gosh, you know, he was going to imprison Hillary and drain the swamp. I mean, here he is assassinating Iranian military leaders?
Well, that's going to happen in the second term.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Well, I know it's coming, right?
Yes.
Breaking the swamp drain, yeah.
So. Well, and so it goes. I mean, it's,
yeah.
Again, people, we've become a nerd to this type of thing. And again, most people think it's normal part of, you know, geopolitics, international relations, for the U.S. to be carrying out unilateral unprovoked attacks on sovereign nations, killing military personnel of other, you know, nations. If Putin arranged for the killing of an American general in Europe somewhere, or some, you know, close to the Russian border, and he boasted he took out a bad guy who's going to do some sinister things, just trust me on this. You know, I got intel on this. Would that be accepted? You know, I doubt it.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's double standard, and the U.S. just takes the position that we are the world dictator. Less and less now do they make a moral, you know, kind of rationalization.
Oh, because it's the irony is too much.
Yeah, there's too much irony and there's too much transparency. I mean, so now it's, you know, we don't even go to the, you know, the motions of some kind of moral justification. We just kill him and then tell people that, well, we don't like him. Now, tomorrow, do you think there's going to be protests in the mainstream media about this act? I mean, what level of protest do you think we're going to see in America's media?
Oh, there'll be no protest. There might be some criticism.
Do you think we'll see some?
I don't think we'll see any protest.
Yeah.
You know, and if they did, it wouldn't be reported anyway. It would be reported in a way that, you know, make it marginalize it. No. I think most Americans see this, they read the paper, oh, well, that's what a superpower does.
Yeah. You know? We really are, as a people, just becoming numb to the nihilistic behavior of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so common now that no one really even complains. They just don't. they've just accepted it. It's sort of like
I mean, there was a time that someone like this would be taken out, you know, make like an accident, a heart attack or something. Heck, they have a heart attack gun. Because should you so you'd have plausible deniability, and now they're just, you know, he just come out and admits it. Yeah. President of the United States admits that he ordered a targeted killing, you know, and claiming some sort of threat that he represented, you know, because, situation in Iraq where you have contractors and military personnel on foreign soil that invaded that country, you know, 15 or 16 years before, and then you say, well, you know, military personnel are threatened or something, or, you know.
And of course it was on a false pretext. I mean,
yes.
The mass destruction weren't even there. So we just went in. I mean, it was like, if you listen to Wesley Clark's interview, and he says, gosh, you know, why are we going into Iraq? And the general he's talking to, according to Clark, and I, you know, don't think Clark is a trustworthy individual, but he does make a clear case in his little concern statement here. And he says, you know, the general just says, well, I don't know it. We don't know what to do, and you know, when you've got a big army like we do, every problem, you know, is a nail, and you just want to hit it.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically there was no rationale at all, and according to Clark, inside the Pentagon, they were just going to lash out. But this is ridiculous. I mean, of course, I mean, just look at the position papers of the New American Century and PNAC. I mean, they had been planning this exact strategy for decades, and they said, we just need a new American Pearl Harbor,
yeah.
Right? That was all we need, and we can go forward, and American people will be, they will just accept it. So, you know, the public is pacified and, well, sad to say, but moronic. They cannot, you know, when 9/11 occurred, it wasn't a large enough fraction to, you know, basically notice that, well, kerosene can't melt steel, so the building shouldn't collapse. So, but, you know, Fox News said it seemed to be okay, and so they just accepted it. Mm-hmm. You know, there it was, and so, you know, they were correct that in the position paper that this you know, they had a new Pearl Harbor, and then the public would really protest, you know, in a dramatic way. And now they've been in there for 20 years, and they're just basically, you can see that it's just a genocide program, and the public is just getting more and more numb. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the incrementalism. It's like, you recall, you know, there were some when they first started the scanning at airports. Remember the security lines?
Yeah.
They're complaining, but now people just walk right in and put their hands up and let the radiation just come right into them. And the same thing with like mandatory vaccinations.
Yeah, and there's the scanning devices. They were deployed after the underwear bomber,
right?
Who was placed on the plane by U.S. intelligence, and that's admitted.
Yeah, I know.
And the, of course, the what was his name? The head of Department of Homeland Security.
Zev. What was his name? The guy who actually created the devices.
What was his name? He was a Department of Justice official.
Yeah, gosh darn it.
He was a spokesman. He was actually headed a marketing firm or a lobbying firm that was actually working on selling the scanning devices to the U.S. government.
Right.
And
I mean,
he testified on Capitol Hill for their use.
Yeah.
And he's going on, you know, different news channels talking about how important they are. And of course, he's Jewish.
Yeah, it was Zev something around. I mean, I forget what it was, but it was a
his
Jewish
nickname was Skeletor.
Yeah, but you know, I always thought the underwear bomber was interesting because he reminded me of like a vacuum cleaner salesman in the 50s. In other words, they, when you want to sell the vacuum, you throw the dirt onto the floor, uh-huh, and then say, "Let me clean it up." Well, so the intelligence agencies actually placed this guy on the plane. And notice that in the pictures of him, he just looks like the most crazed terrorist imaginable. You know,
yes.
He's just classic. And then they go, well, I guess, darn it, I guess we're going to have to scan everybody with radiation. You know?
Michael Chertoff.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, Michael, that guy. Really just unbelievably evil. But, you know, the thing is that the public is just.
He also helped get the dancing Israelis out of the country.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Real patriot. Which country? But You know, we have become used to, you know, more and more a kind of slave condition. And part of it is, you know, this Soliman stuff where, you know, you just go, well, gosh darn it, doesn't seem to be, no one else is complaining. I guess I don't need to complain either, you know? So we just accept it. And then they then can just slowly ratchet it up. But, you know, people should protest this because for so many reasons. But, I mean, one of them is you really want to regenerate this idea that humanity has some intrinsic value. Because I don't think the oligarchs are believing that at this point. And they, if you don't push back, they're just going to push you right off the planet. Yeah.
Well, that's I think that that's about the, how much value they place on human life. It's a commodity, something to be traded with or discarded if it becomes a liability based on their balance sheets.
Yeah. Well, if you're not in the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you look going back to the expulsion of the Palestinians, you can see how they, you know, they talk about this kind of relative value, very clarifying to see the actual letters of the of these the second wave of Zionism, you know, the ones that's kind of spun off from Herzl. This would be like Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, Golda Meir, you know, there's they all became the prime minister of Israel basically down the road. But you know, there's a kind of clarity and you know, when they talk, they actually use a term which basically means the N-word. It just means subhuman. And that's kind of how they, well, not kind of, it's exactly how they characterized the Palestinians. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's a collection of photographs of the Palestinian culture before the exodus, the occupation by the Zionists. And it is just heartbreaking because the it shows how civilized, how cultured, and how human these people were. You know, I mean, they have pictures of like the medical facilities, the schools. You know, the Palestine, when it's characterized by the Zionists, you know, they're saying, well, it's basically just, you know, this kind of barbaric clump. But then when you see the photographic evidence of what it was really like, it's just absolutely heartbreaking because, you know, they really were just, you know, an amazingly civilized group. They were just poor and in the wrong place.
Yeah. Well, so it wasn't a country without a people for a people without a country?
Not exactly. It was more densely populated than the United States. And, you know, that saying, that's a critical saying for people to understand, because that saying, which actually Marsala in the book, he quotes, but he's quoting a Zionist who paraphrases it. It's this complicated Jewish name, but that guy became kind of known for the phrase, you know, and so that's, you know, this is this kind of like, you know, then gets repeated in the media. But the fact is, it was actually, I believe, Shaftberry, the Freemason, in the middle of the 19th century, like 1830, somewhere right around in there, who actually coined the phrase. And so, again, it just is important so that people can understand the whole process of Israel, because, you know, now they only give us this fraction of it. And then, of course, it's usually just ludicrous, like the movie Exodus, basically, what people think of, you know, which is just one of the most just literally insane propaganda pieces imaginable. I don't know if have you ever seen the movie?
Not all the way through, but enough of it.
The Palestinians are working with the Nazis.
Yes.
I mean, it's completely insane, but this is, you know, how they characterize the situation. And so, you know, that's how the American public got to be aware of it. But the process was this long, Masonic process, you know, that ended up with the second wave of Zionists with the group with particularly David Ben-Gurion, who was kind of coming from Theodore Herzl's perspective. But it's only because the history has been truncated. They don't like to talk about the proto-Zionists, the Churchill family, the Spencers, all the British Freemasons, because mm-hmm. then this would put a big question mark about just history in general. You see what I mean? It's a critical thing. I hope people who are, listening would take the time to actually do the research, which is the documents are available. You can certainly go to Nur Masala's book, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, which is just fantastic documentation of what happened. So anyway, the Solomon situation just takes us one step closer. It's really going to be interesting to see the response. Would you care to hazard a guess as to what Iran will do as to respond to this event?
I'd probably say they're probably not going to do anything directly. And if they don't do anything, a false flag would be carried out and be blamed on them.
So they may as well get a punch in it.
Well, that might be their thing. I know. So we're going to get blamed anyway.
Yeah.
Another, like the fake gas attacks in Syria.
Yeah, I just worry that this sets up, when you look at the PNAC documents and you listen to Clark, you can see that all of these countries have been on the chopping block for mm-hmm. basically since Lord Shaftesbury in the 1830s. And so since they've pretty well got, everything in such a mess, and all of the Arab states have been weakened so that they can't possibly organize as a unified force against American Israeli alliance. Well, why not do Iran now? This might be the time. It's only, the question mark is what kind of technology can Iran use against the U.S. military or even against the United States if it gets to that degree? They just conducted a military or naval exercise with China and Russia. I don't know if that's a real alliance, but they did, actually do this exercise. So this seems like it could lead to trouble. And of course, the Iranians are known to have, sophisticated missiles.
Yeah, silkworm missiles and China's
yeah,
made
so anyway, yeah. It has the potential to be an insane mess. And
the U.S. hasn't really fought a war against a country that can shoot back since the Second World War. So, and these aircraft carriers are just lumbering giants, for a missile.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. No, they would be, if in fact they have this sunburn missile, which it isn't really something that the Aegis system, at least as the technology was in existence a few years ago, could really defeat. They're just too fast, and they just get in on you immediately, and then they don't even have to have a direct hit. They're so fast, they have so much mass that they just pass by you close by. They'll rip everything out of the boat. These things are really, really powerful. And so, anyway, so it's just I just kind of hope that. That it can calm down. I don't really know, what to think about the future here in this regard.
Maybe it depends on how much information or blackmail they have on various senators, so they can put pressure on the impeachment trial.
And yeah.
So they say if Trump doesn't do our bidding against Iran, we'll impeach him. But if he, so the Senate, everyone's, because the Senate's Republican controlled, that the impeachment's dead in the water unless some pressure is brought to bear, which is always a possibility, which is why you have operations like Jeffrey Epstein, and there's more than his wasn't the only one to control the political process, to put pressure behind the scenes. So that's speculation, but that's one other factor that could be a factor in this.
Sure. It's a kind of mess that could easily get into our political. In fact, it should. I would love to see it actually become a political something like a talking point, if nothing else.
I mean, it could be why this attack was ordered in the first place. you know.
Yeah.
Not as if, like this this stuff is openly talked about, you know.
Well, it's just like, you know, we need distractions. You know, like I was listening that there are people claiming that Pizzagate is about to return, and they have videos now that they were on, Wiener's laptop, and they're going.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but these rumors have been circulating for years, and they never seem to come to anything. And that they provide a kind of distraction. It's almost like they're perfectly effective in terms of just keeping people from looking at the real situation, which is, frankly, the fact that we're being depopulated. Segueing into Japan, I had sent you that article on the Japanese demographics, mm-hmm. and basically, they are coming out of existence. The collapse is happening even faster than they had anticipated. This was the first year since the 19th century that there were fewer than 1 million babies born in Japan. So and of course they've been famous for their health. You know, the Japanese health, particularly infants, have been very strong. But now they're starting, the toxicity is starting to spill out, and a lot, there's actually now, as I look at getting some data, that they're starting to see some of the problems that we are. They're actually responding, I think, in the right way. They're trying to reduce the toxicity. There is some in Japan now, some pushback against vaccinations, mm-hmm. which of course, on the real federal level, what politician is actually breaching the idea that the mandatory vaccination programs are evil, you know, are wrong, are basically a restriction of freedom, and could have the potential to be absolutely catastrophic to children and everybody. But no politician is even, that I can see, is even talking about this. You know, everyone just seems to be following the line, safe and effective, on the political class. And if it wasn't for the alt media, they'd be just vaccinating right and left, you know. The Japanese, and the reason that I wanted to bring this up is just because I thought that it's a valuable thing for people to be aware of, is that the Japanese, if you look at their, you know, why are there so few births? Well, the primary and easiest to understand cause is the sperm. The sperm count has just collapsed in Japan. They over like 15% have a sperm count below the level, which would be like 15 million sperm per millimeter, I believe, from which they are likely to even be capable of producing a child. And so this is, is just, you know, a disaster. And I think we should pay attention to this, because I think in Japan, they're actually going to try to do something. Here, the government seems to be absolutely delighted that the sperm count is collapsing, right? I mean, who's bringing it up? But I think in Japan, you're going to start seeing more and more people speaking out. Because they are, some of the Japanese politicians are not controlled, and they're going to say, wait a second, what's going on here? What we need to have some science applied to the toxicity, otherwise we're going to go out of existence.
Yeah, Japan's population has been getting older. For almost a century. But for the first part of the 20th century, Japan had a population problem. I mean, they couldn't produce enough food to feed the population. But since the Second World War and they were liberalized, the trend's gone the other way. Between 2000 and 2010, the country's population age 65 and over increased by 7 million. And this population is likely to increase by another 7 million. This is according to UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs. According to the government's official population projections conducted by the National Institute of Population and Social Security Research, the elderly population will continue to grow, though at a slower pace, until it peaks at around 2040 when the second baby boomer generation, the second of the post-war baby boomers, passes the age of 65. At this time, a much smaller, younger population will face the task of supporting this larger number of elderly Japanese. There's a labor shortage, and they're calling for bringing in foreign workers to fill the gap. So we're seeing that trend again.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that if your population is below replacement level and you have a labor shortage, the way you address that is you have more babies. So you create a pro-natalist policy. But since Japan was liberalized, it's been gradually become an anti-natalist society. What's the marriage rate of Japanese men under the age of 30?
It's very low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before
the show, you brought up an amazing fact, which was actually kind of ground zero for sort of the development of feminism in Japan. It goes back to the period right after World War II, when the Freemason Douglas MacArthur, he not only, put in positions of power Japanese Freemasons,
mm-hmm.
brought in someone to actually help write the Constitution. Can you tell us about this individual, Tim?
Yeah, they're a 22-year-old Jewish American. Biete Sirota Gordon. She was installed on the General MacArthur's staff to help write the Constitution, the part concerning the rights of women. And she was a feminist, a champion of civil rights and equality for all, supposedly. So we have a Jewish lady writing the Japanese post-war Constitution, which imposes feminism on the Japanese culture. And this might have something to do with the state that Japan is in today. When you disrupt traditional society, of course, Japanese culture is portrayed, traditional culture is portrayed in the most pathological ways. Yeah, that's usually what they do. But if liberalization leads to the to the eclipse of your people, maybe you should start thinking about supposed equal rights and women's liberation. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like you scratch your head, maybe wonder about. But I was amazed because, I mean, this is 1945.
Yes.
Now, 1945, really, there was actually a feminist? It reminded me of like last week, or not last week, when we were talking about the Club of Rome. I was looking at this guy who had been writing like 1930s about the coming Jewish state, and mm-hmm. And he had this idea of the New World Order, and how the League of Nations was this going to be this thing that would like bring about this New World Order. And this was like in the 1930s. You go, wait a second. How can this idea of Zionism being a component and the most important part of this New World Order be an idea back in 1930? When you brought up the idea of a MacArthur finding basically a feminist in 1945, I mean, must have been the only one in America. How did he get his hands on one?
I guess that she, submitted her application, did well with the interview, and that was it.
That was it. She must have done really well.
In the context, most people understand that when Japan surrendered, MacArthur rolled in, and he, as an American Caesar, and he came in and he liberalized, modernized Japan, and set it up for its post-war expansion. And most people see a very benign influence there. And maybe for the first few decades, it appears as such. Japanese products, their export markets, they make great automobiles and things like that. People usually, that's what we associate with modern Japan. Again, this is the final penetration of Japan, which you know, which had been going back about a century. You know, when Commodore Perry showed up, who was a Freemason, and you have the Freemason penetration of Japan in the middle of the 19th century. But Japan society, you know, its post-war situation was set up by the CIA. Its Liberal Democratic Party was funded, and this was working in conjunction with various criminal entities or networks. I think they're called Yakuzas.
Yakuzas.
And so this is all, you know, very dirty, but basically they set up a sort of a faux democracy, you know, where they would do the bidding of the U.S. government. Suppose this is done to fight communism. Supposedly communism is a threat. So they have to support criminal gangs to suppress communist threat. And, you know, same excuse was used in Italy and in Europe in the Cold War. But you're setting up more or less, you're setting up an economy, a political system on top of this criminal network that's doing the bidding of the CIA, which represents sort of the oligarch criminal elements in the West. So Japan is completely folded into the Western system at this point. This goes back again to the Meiji Restoration, when Japan modernized its navy and its army under European, advisors and auspices, and they became a power, sort of a modern power in Asia, and they were sort of the cat's paw for British and American policy in Asia. You know, they went to war against Japan. Against Russia, largely. Jacob Schiff was a big part of that, funding that, going against Russia. And they were, of course, they were allies in the First World War. Of course, the Second World War comes around, and Japan needs to be, perhaps, is getting too big for everyone's, you know, for their britches, and they have to be knocked down. And they're drawn to the war, and you know, they their empire is smashed, and it's folded into the post-war system, the Anglo-American Zio Empire. So it's never been fully independent, but culturally, Japan was conquered, and so it became gradually westernized and secularized in the post-war period. And so that's probably had a big influence on its birth rates, because much of what we call J-pop or popular culture is sort of this fusion of American Western pop culture and Japanese culture. And it's produced sort of a perverse culture. You've actually lived in Japan, right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I did, yeah.
And you have this odd mixture now, you know, which you'll see a lot in Tokyo, right? That's like sort of all the lights and it's sort of a Times Square type atmosphere to it.
Yeah, very sterile, clean, and amazingly electric.
Yeah.
It's just like 23rd century kind of appearance. The people, I think, are sadly unaware that they are basically in a faux, political system. They don't really understand that their political system was taken over in the same way, basically, Americans don't understand it. But that there are just a whole team of lifetime actors that, you know, pretend to be, you know, Japanese politicians, but they don't really represent the people. They're completely in the thrall. Most of them are Freemasons. I mean, MacArthur installed a Japanese Freemason, political class, right? And it's never changed. I can't find any particular moment when there was a rebellion against this. They've been in power ever since. The public has gotten used to kind of the fake nature of it. And unfortunately, it looks like someone is giving these people directions to, you know, bring the population way down, you know, because it's obviously deliberate what's going on. I mean, they have to be fully aware that they're...
Well, like I said earlier, it's gotten to the point where you have to, you know, create robots to change the diapers of the old people. And you have to bring in foreign workers to meet the labor shortage, that you should get to work and start having babies and, you know, reverse the population decline. And the thing is, if that happens, if you start pouring in foreigners in Japan to meet the labor demand, slowly you will destroy the Japanese race. It'll become something entirely different.
That is the plan, because it's happening there in the same way it's happening in Europe.
Yes.
They're just two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Europe, you have many more ethnicities to, you know, blend out of existence. But and of course, reduce the population.
And like so I said, feminism If this idea of total equality and feminism leads to the eclipse of your race, then it's not a good philosophy.
Well, you know, like,
you got to come up with something else. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this one didn't work out. It's sort of like if you look at the inner cities, and remember that the original thrust behind the Great Society programs was feminist. You know, that women need to have basically an economic footing that would give them equality, and that this was going to lead to a workers' paradise,
independence,
right?
Independence by going on welfare.
Right. And, well, I mean, that was the argument. And now when you walk through basically looking like, you know, cities that look like, well, like Detroit, I mean, like it's their bombed out ruins, and the culture and, you know, the every single demographic, you know, kind of misery marker is through the roof. You'd think they would go, well, maybe this was just the wrong idea. Maybe the Great Society feminist combination just wasn't really a good idea. And in Japan, I would think the same thing is true. And it'd be interesting to know what kind of political correctness there is, because, you know, they don't have, it's harder to bring up the idea of racism. Right.
Yes.
They can certainly bring up feminism as a kind of a culture of critique they can apply against, you know, Japanese males. But I think it must be more complicated. The propaganda mind control must be more complicated. You know, when you have just when there's not they can always play one ethnicity against another. Right. For effect.
Yes.
You know, this is like, simple. And so it makes it easy to, you know, you're a racist. The white male is bad. These groups are good. Let's put them in ascendancy, and then blur everybody into a kind of slave state, you know, where no one can resist the oligarchs. Harder to do in Japan, you know, but they are doing it. So I hope that there would be pushback by the Japanese people, you know, and particularly technologic pushback, where they actually, someone should get in there and look at work some science and try to come up with exactly the toxicity aspects. And then also there should be some people to stand up for basically the family, right? Because this is really, if you think about, well, what can really cure Japan? What there's really only one thing. It's the reconstitution of the family culture. Mm-hmm. That's it. Same is true for European. I mean, if there was some, you know, complicated Rube Goldberg kind of possible other thing, I'd be promoting it. There just isn't that I can see. You're either promoting the family culture with the idea of, you know, reconstituting ethnicity and, kind of like the father involved in the political aspect of the family, right? This kind of idea.
Yeah, well, these
are you going out of existence? You know?
Because what happens is that's consistent with nature, so it works.
Yeah.
But it conflicts with ideology, with this radical, you know, equality in these things, which is all about slavery. Because you're going to have to revert to traditional roles, and that runs contrary to, you know, modern thinking, or the zeitgeist of postmodernism and these things, where, you know, everything needs to be equal. The distinctions and restrictions keep us healthy. It's like same way if you know the organs of your body have a certain function, and they have to be your stomach. You have to eat properly for your stomach to function properly, so it can feed the body. Implied in that are certain rules you have to follow about how much you eat and what you eat. You know, it's the same thing with how people conduct, you know, how people treat with how the opposite sexes engage each other. There's a certain nature to it, logos to it. And if you violate that, there's consequences. And we're seeing the consequences of that.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, how about starting with the idea that there's two sexes?
Well, yeah, because talk about, I mean, you'll see a lot of that. Japan was sort of the avant-garde of that, because, you know, you have these weird ideas of sexual avatars and, you know, robots. Sure. And these things. And that there's something in the modern Asian culture which tends to be more interested in that. You know what I'm talking, the weird Asian.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. And but I think that's all like post-World War II.
Yeah, it's all post-World War II.
Pornographic culture that comes from the Freemasons.
Yes.
I think if you go back, you know, 100 years, you'd have a very healthy heterosexual family-oriented culture. But now you have not just kind of like strange robotic sex kind of pornography, but the gay culture and the transvestite culture is very, very powerful now in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
They're very common. And of course, how common are they? In fact, I don't know, but their presence in the media is basically, you know, like 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I was there, I was just, so many of the presenters on TV, just like the United States.
Yes.
You know, you like when I was this summer, I was in Barcelona and you know, the various Mediterranean places. And I think I saw like four homosexual couples out of like, you know, like 500,000 people. I mean, I was wandering around the streets all day, you know, and I couldn't. But if you look at the TV and in the advertisements, it's as though that, well, we're already basically a transgender homosexual world because that's all that they promote.
Here was, so, I think it was Daryl Hamamoto, his book. He wrote a book about this, but you know, sort of the conformism that you see in Asian culture, and how they're perfect agents of the administrative state. So their attitudes about things. But he's commented on sort of the decline of Asian masculinity.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, I you know, I know Daryl, and I've talked to him a couple times about this, and he. It was great that he was actually able kind of to sound the alarm, you know, way early on about this very subject, that the, you know, that Asian males were basically losing their masculinity.
He says they're literally, if you go back two, three generations, they're physically different than what they appear now.
You know, and I'll tell you the truth. I think it's correct because I have a actual real life memory of Japanese males in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw them. I was with them. And they were virile.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of samurai.
Mm-hmm.
I remember how muscular they were. And, you know, these were men. A lot of them had been killed in World War II, but the ones that were left, the ones that were coming up, man, they were tough. And now I don't see it. It's the same thing, Tim, when I go to this one club here in Santa Barbara where they have pictures of the 1930s and 40s and 50s, you know, on the wall.
Everyone's thin.
you look at the pictures and then you look outside and it's like two different species. I mean, the people out there today are like on average maybe 25 pounds overweight, but moreover, particularly the males, they don't have any muscular kind of aspect to them. But in the 30s and 40s, they all look like, you know, Johnny Weissmuller. You know, these were like, you know, very virile men. And so part of what they're doing to us is they have the homosexual culture, but then they also have the homosexual, basically toxic agenda. You know, this toxic agenda to transform males into women, you know, with all of the things that they, the people who are studying the Japanese were mentioning, you know, that you have basically these estrogen producing chemicals that are in the clothes and the food, they're everywhere. And so you end up with, you know, you have this blurred individual. Physically, and then of course the culture is right there waiting to scoop him up.
But it's ironic that you can create depopulation by promoting, or apparently ironic it isn't if you think about it, promoting degenerate sexuality.
Yeah,
but
absolutely
it starts, you know, because first of all, people forget that it's about, you know, procreation and it's about recreation, you know, pleasure, and so then they, you know, they'll institute things like birth control and inevitably abortion and infanticide to get rid of the inconvenient, you know, consequences of it. But yeah, I was listening to talk about how many people characterize, you know, Islamic countries. You know, people wear the hijabs, they cover their heads, and this is so barbaric. Look what they do to the women. And the guy pointed out, if you go back 100 years ago, women didn't leave the house with their hair exposed, and men didn't either. They wore hats, you know. And, 50 years ago, you wouldn't see women jogging around in sports bras. You do now, right?
Yeah.
So 50 years ago, American dress was as restrictive as it is in Iran today, which is portrayed as being, you know, or, you know, if you go to Iran, you see women, they wear that and they do it kind of fashionably, so it's attractive.
Yeah, they were
it's there. Nonsense. Yeah. 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 You know, but, and of course, traditional Catholic women used to cover, you know, their veils in churches and anything. But then, you know, it's not that, we're not that far removed from it to begin with. The second of all is, what about tolerance for other cultures? And second and third of all is, the reality is, if you stop doing that, inevitably you get women wearing, you know, you get the degeneracy you see in the West. You know.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that the pornographic culture is a process of extinguishing an ethnicity, and you know, even though it's touted as a workers' paradise, sexual liberation. Remember that expression.
Yeah.
What does it really end up with in terms of the statistics? It ends up with no families, and you can see that, you know. The moral structure that was the object of the culture of critique, right? Because when the Frankfurt School guys went after Western civilization, they targeted specifically, the aspects of morality and behavior, right? Mm-hmm. That were like, you know, like a male dominated family, right? Okay, so that shows up on the authoritarian scale,
mm-hmm.
right? And then on the fascism scale, and this leads to fascism. And then, of course, you have, you know, no equality. So all of those, the critique, the negativity that they were saying, this is bad, that's bad, that. Well, they didn't ever mention, yeah, but these are components of a process by which you actually have a viable existing ethnicity and race. The people who are in this day and age who are bringing forward these critiques, you know, the one thing I always try to ask them is go, well, wait a second, you don't even have a culture that can replicate itself. This is how bad these ideas are. You look at the statistics. I mean, I had this argument with this feminist the other day. I was going, look, I don't have to wait long. You'll be out of existence in just two generations. This is how bad your philosophy is. You know, there are legitimate feminist positions because the word is, you know, the term is very broad. But in the way that she was using it, the application of the culture of critique, it doesn't go anywhere, Tim. It goes out of existence in about two generations. Mm-hmm. They can't even replicate itself. So I would say that a cultural idea that by definition leads to extinction, I think we could probably write that idea off, right? This is not a, you know, sensible one.
Yeah, unless the purpose is extinction. Then, it is working the way it's supposed to
there
work.
There you have it, right. Yes. And that's what we... You know, we all, I know that like listeners may, you know, like wonder about how often we come back to this, but it is so critical because this is where it all ends up. They give you the workers' paradise, all of this hocus pocus. It ends up with you being out of existence. That's what the plan is. They've weaponized all of these terms, you know, in Japan, they have, you know, they have this, assault on the family, which is directed by feminists who they focus on the mother-in-law. They, in the former Japanese culture, often the woman would go to live with the man's family.
Mm-hmm.
And there are legendary stories about mothers of the, you know, who were domineering and the woman wasn't free. And then, you know, so that now has been completely shattered and the woman is in the marketplace competing against the man and there's no children. And so this supposed to be is better, but you know, I would argue, well, at least the old culture could replicate itself.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's one thing you run into is they'll take some sort of grievance or problem and use it as an excuse to implement their, you know, their destructive ideology, their plan. There's a good example. You take the idea of rights of children, and the UN has proclaimed this. Certain governments have signed on to the Declaration of the Universal Rights of Children. And all that sounds good. Who's against children having rights? you know, against abuse, all mistreatment, all that stuff. But when you think how it's the practical implementation of these things, of these laws, means that the state steps in and represents the children, and the family, the mother and father, are marginalized. And what's the practical effect of that?
Yeah, and then just go back to Huxley's book, because that was the, you know, one of the key templates for the future. The state has always had been trying to figure a way to get control over the production and education of the children. Mm-hmm. And so when you have, you know, it's, you know, the UN, it's just this ludicrous, bogus facade, basically, to put in slave techniques with a happy face, right? And because they're, the United Nations, I mean, these are, you know, again, it's just another version of the workers' paradise coming to you. And of course, like they all always do, they always bring genocide, you know, yes. You have the happy face, and then, well, you look, if the kids will just, you know, give them a little more rights and the parents have a little less, and oh, of course, we need the state to step in. Well, then where does this go? Well, where this goes to is the epsilons and delta class. The humanity has been basically extinguished, and what you have left are...
Well, it's like when they tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment in the United States in the 70s. And it's, well, just, what are you against equality between men and women? Well, yeah, I am. Sorry. They're not the same. What do you mean by equality? Well, you know, let's get in the details here. Well, yeah. It turns out that's where the devil is, ma'am. I'm sorry. But, you know, when people started scrutinizing equal rights, what you're saying, this might lead to conscription of women. This might lead to the banning of male and female bathrooms and the destruction of single-sex education, private institutions. A lot of the stuff has been implemented through the courts. You know, thank you for judges like, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They've done it through judicial activism. That's why it was stopped, because people thought about it for a second. I don't think that today you get that level of reflection, but it was stopped by activism. Thank you for Phyllis Schlafly. But people thought how crazy it was. Well, there are legitimate distinctions. Sometimes you don't want equality. There are legitimate reasons to discriminate and differences, and they should be implemented or instantiated in laws and custom. Not every distinction is wrong. They use this talk of equality to destroy the institutions society relies upon to replicate. And we're seeing what's happening, you know?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And also happiness. I mean, the thing is, you know, they would go after what could be characterized as negative aspects of family life.
Yeah, right? Just pathologize anything, right? Just,
right, but anything can be apologized. Anything can be critiqued. But wait a second, what kind of love and camaraderie and family feeling was also contained inside this little box that had, you know, some problems and some strengths? I mean, and now, of course, in hindsight, we can see that, well, we needed it, warts and all, because it actually had the power of replication, whereas the modern family is basically non-existent, and it's just it's on its way, it's vaporizing, and the state is stepping in with, you know, with they're going to have control over production of humans here in a few generations for sure, and the education will just be a conditioning situation. Well, the idea of a free thinking human being is just is nonsensical. Mm-hmm. You know, that's only going to be for the chosen people who are at the top. Everyone else will be conditioned into, you know, loving their servitude, you know. So, yeah, Brave New World, man. Doesn't look too good to me. I'm guys like us, we're really not designed for it, you know. We think about freedom and also health, you know, physical health, family health, you know. We care about those things, so we're not. I'm afraid we stand in the way of progress, don't we, Tim?
Yes. Yeah. So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Good talking to you, buddy. We'll get him next week.
Enjoy your weekend.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.